Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast at peterbcollins.com. Prepare to have your mind changed about the dire impacts of climate change. They are real. But the good news is there is a plan for 2100 and 4 degrees warming. And it's encapsulated in a powerful new book that is rich in graphics and information called 2100, A Dystopian Utopia. And today, you're going to meet the woman who put this book together. It was a 5-year project, a huge team. And they have a plan. It's going to require major changes in human behavior, and there are going to be less cities and more moving people, as predicted in this Fix song from back in the 1980s.
Another home falls by the wayside. A few old cushions stuffed with pride.
This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including Jeff Lipinski, Paul Lacombe, Don Cisney, and the fine folks at DGL Engraving. They kick in $5 or $10 a month. You can do it too. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber, and you can take it from there. I hope you'll share this podcast with people who are concerned about climate change. And I hope they find it fascinating and inspiring, like I have. Here on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we've brought you a lot of dire news about climate change and its impacts. Dar Jamail's The End of Ice, just recently. We've interviewed the heroic valve turners who put their lives on the line to block the shipment of tar sands crude into the United States. We've covered the lawsuits blocking construction of the Keystone XL pipeline and the dire news that many people believe is too conservative from the IPCC, the UN Climate Change Panel. Today, we're going to take a different look at the impact of climate change, because you'll be gratified to know that there's actually a plan for the year 2100, and it's been put together by a team of architects, and it's compiled into a book that I have in my hands here called 2100, A Dystopian Utopia. And the woman responsible for this book is Vanessa Keith, who joins us today by Skype. Vanessa, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
And as I tried to explain in the setup here, I really am inspired by the work that you've done, and you didn't do it alone. This was a 5-year project with a team of designers and researchers, and the book is so impressive. Just it's not a coffee table book by any means, but the production values, the vivid graphics, and the charts, the design elements are so impressive. I just want you to take a bow here, because this is one of the most unique books and timely books that I've seen in quite a while.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. You know, we wanted to make it vivid for people. And if I can be optimistic after doing 5+ years of climate research on cities, I think that anyone can. And I have a lot of faith in our ability to push it forward and to solve problems and to be intelligent as humans are. And so my writing this book was really about, let's roll up our sleeves and start doing stuff.
And the song that I used has been a favorite of mine since it was released in the mid-80s by the band called The Fix. And it is prophetic because what you describe in the book is fewer cities, less cities, and more people moving around. We've got to give up the ground in many cases that we currently occupy because the weather and sea levels and other factors are going to make it, in many cases, unlivable. And before we dive into the book, Vanessa, I just want to talk a little bit about your publisher. It's called Urban Research, and this is the second title that I've covered in an interview. Jordan H. Carver was with us a few months ago, and he published this remarkable analysis of the U.S. torture and rendition programs by looking at it from an architectural and design perspective. And I've been covering Guantanamo and those issues for many years, and he just opened a whole new angle that I found so interesting, and I put your book in the same category. Tell us a little bit about Urban Research. It's a fairly new publishing house set up by Michael Sorkin, right?
Yes. Michael Sorkin is wonderful, and so is Urban Research. They are incredibly just motivated, scrappy. They are really interested in work that is activist and forward-thinking. They have a strong commitment to cities and the future of cities and to promoting intelligent discourse on cities. And so it's really wonderful to be a part of this club. I'm really honored to have been given a voice for my work.
And you imagine the future on a pretty conservative projection. You look at 4 degrees Celsius warming of the planet by 2100. And we're certainly on a path to exceed that at this point. And as I referenced, Dar Jamail's most recent book called The End of Ice chronicles the prospect of very rapid acceleration of the warming process. There's so much heat that has been captured in the oceans, and that is producing, of course, the melting of glaciers and the polar caps. And there are certainly many unknowns, but we know that we're in a pretty bad pickle, and that we're not seeing adequate response from our political leaders. And so I think that this is a fascinating contribution to give people blueprints, actual blueprints for cities of the future. And you kind of did a zero-based approach where you don't imagine that the way things are today is the way things they need to be, the way that things need to be 80 years from now.
Right. So I guess I'll sort of go back to the beginning. When we started doing this research, 4 degrees seemed outrageous.
Yeah. Like
it didn't seem conservative. So it's kind of funny to hear it called conservative now, because now we sort of feel like, wow, 4 degrees, that would be great. If we could get it to stop there, that would be
right.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you a picture, before we started this research or when we started this research, my office, Studio Teca, always does a summer sort of, summer research, we try to balance our, commercial work and our architecture work also with work that enables us to sort of push the research and development of the office forward. And so we had spent some time doing some work on deforestation. And we were looking at the Amazon rainforest, and we were, part of a group with a friend of mine who was actually like traveling down the river through the Amazon. And we were, we were these teams all, and it ended up with me sort of in New York asking myself why I was browbeating people in the Amazon when I could also look closer to home in terms of what are we doing in New York. And so we started calculating the surface area of the buildings of New York and looking at places that we could deploy devices that, we called clip-on architecture that could be, say, generating energy or absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere, not just on roofs. I mean, we all know that roofs should be white, and this is something that we've been saying for years, and it's only now just starting to happen. you know, we're looking at all of those things. And I think, you know, we bring people in, including Michael Sorkin and other friends and other colleagues and people from different fields to critique and to see the work. And so in one of these things, you know, Michael asked if I wanted to, you know, he said, well, would you like to do this competition to get a book, book deal? And so we did the competition, but, you know, we had just finished a bunch of stuff and we were tired and maybe we didn't put enough into it or whatever. But for whatever reason, we didn't get that.
Oh.
But then he said, would you like to be a part of my book series? And we are UR3. So we're the third book mm-hmm. in the series. And that was just fantastic. That was even better than the book deal that we would have gotten if we had won that other thing.
Now let's talk a little bit about why he wanted to collaborate with you, because you have a pretty fascinating background. You got a bachelor's at Columbia, majoring in religion and non-Western philosophy. Then you picked up a master's at Columbia in international and public affairs. And then you got your architecture ticket at the University of Pennsylvania. So you are an interdisciplinary scholar who brings a lot to this work.
Well, you know, I've always, when I started teaching at City College, I would go to Michael's reviews for his graduate students. And I just found it fascinating the way that they would, you know, the way that they would frame a discourse. Like, for example, I went one time and they had like a whole gigantic model of this fantastical city with like, you know, and everything was obviously very like, you know, non-car focused and like, how are we, you know, all of these, and this was just fantastical worlds. And what he would do is they each had like a section of it, like a square or something. And they would do all of this stuff on the square. And then he would say, okay, you have to switch. Because why? Because when you're working in a city, you don't get tabula rasa most of the time. You actually end up having to work on stuff that other people have had and add to it. And you also inherit the problems of whatever was going on before.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've always stayed in touch with him. I've always, you know, been on his reviews or invited him to mine or things like that. And, you know, he's just a fantastic mentor. He's also one of those people in my field who is, he's just very, generous in, you know, in helping to collaborate and to promote other designers in a way that not everybody else does. And so I think we have an affinity in terms of ideas. And, you know, they've been tremendous in supporting all of the talks that I've given and, you know, coming out to events. I was at Drawdown Learn, which was fantastic with Paul Hawken and the Project Drawdown team and a whole bunch of people, which was a few months ago in Rhinebeck, New York. You know, that was really great. You know, and I'm sort of losing my track here in terms of what the question was, but yeah, like they've been absolutely phenomenal.
Well, what you actually did there was an exercise in deflection, and I respect your humility, but you have a lot to be proud of. So, Vanessa,
oh, you're talking about my multidisciplinary background.
That's right.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I studied international affairs and economic development, and I really, after I got out of that degree, I sort of felt like I want to have more to offer the world than just to say I went to Columbia and so you should do what I say. You know, I just thought that didn't sound good. And so I thought, well, you know, all of the jobs that I wanted, you needed some sort of professional ability. So I thought, well, you know, it's either engineering or architecture. And I had always been an artist. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, I'll do architecture. And so that's how I ended up going into architecture. As a person, I am Italian, Jamaican, and Chinese. So I am this like weird international mixture as well. So cross-disciplinary work and building bridges and crossing boundaries is something that comes very natural to me. And thinking outside of the box also comes very naturally to me.
Now, Vanessa, I want you to know that I read a lot of books, I interview a lot of authors, and I'm brutal on books. I bend back the pages, I highlight things, I mark them up, you know, marginal comments, but I couldn't do that to your book. and so I have it in front of me here with a bunch of Post-it notes to identify the pages that I want to highlight. So I'd like to give our listeners a little quick tour of the book so that they have an idea of what they would find if they pick up a copy and start to absorb it. So I'm opening up here with a graphic called Inhabitable Zones. And if I'm right, this is a Mercator projection, right? That's when you put the world on a flat map.
I believe so. But what we did is we also included Antarctica, which nobody ever includes. Mm-hmm. You know, in the world map, you never see the far north and the far south, right?
Right.
Like it just gets cut off.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're not media markets, so.
Well, maybe they're going to be.
So what you show is that the habitable zones where people can grow food and live in a relatively comfortable climate are pretty far north. Basically, it looks like about the 41st parallel. I'm at 38 here in San Francisco, so I'm just guessing. But you basically draw a line that is below the U.S.-Canadian border in most places. But it gives a very graphic sense of where the climate is shifting and where human habitat is going to be found in 2100.
Well, what I like to say when I give talks on the book is if you draw a line from, say, the tip of South America across, or, you know, the tip of South America, South Africa, sort of around there, mm-hmm. and then you draw a line from, you know, the United States across, that area becomes the area that's really unstable and not that great for large scale populations. And when we first did that map, this was before Hurricane Sandy, you know, it was before Maria, before Harvey, and all of these things, before the wildfires in California, all of these things had not happened yet. And so people were, when we would present this in our in-office reviews, people would say, nobody could believe it. And people would say, oh, come on, but you know this is science fiction, right? And I was like, no, actually, it's not science fiction. And we got to do something about it. So that graphic that you're talking about is probably one of the most compelling pieces of evidence. And I think it really points to the power also of design thinking in giving you the ability to visualize a problem really clearly, because that map is the result of pages and pages and pages and pages of my team and I reading all of these studies and all of these articles to turn it into, okay, this is what it's going to be like. This is where you're going to have, you know, fires, and these are the areas where you're going to have cyclonic storms like hurricanes, you know, and all of this. You start to look at this and you say, wow, that's, you know, why are we doing this to ourselves?
And Vanessa, I don't know if you're familiar with Chris Hedges, and he coined the term sacrifice zones to describe abandoned inner city, former manufacturing areas here in the United States. But as I look at this map, about two-thirds of the current United States would become almost a sacrifice zone of a different kind.
That's very true. And you look at this and you think about, there's a tremendous amount of resistance to just facing this and looking at this as a reality. And until we look at it, we're not going to be able to solve it. But when I look at for example, the inhabitable zones, you know, which is that green one, you start to look at that and you think, okay, politically, what are we doing here? We're basically creating two superpowers. If you look at that, we've got superpower Canada on the left and superpower Russia on the right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what it's going to be. And we may find ourselves at the southern border of Canada.
I hope they don't build a wall.
Well, they just might.
I'd rather build seawalls myself around Vancouver.
So you look at this and you know, my whole point is the technologies and techniques that are referenced in this book that you see in these cities of the future are things we can start to do now. So why don't we start to do that now instead of waiting for this to happen?
Well, you know, we got to wait for the quarterly dividends and, you know, profit reports, and we really can't see much beyond the next quarter. So, gosh, I don't know how
well, you know,
we can get engaged in decades-long planning.
here's the thing. This is what gives me hope. So first of all, and this is what I was talking about in terms of the crisis of thinking or imagination, or, you know, we have these sort of mental blocks or boundaries to that block our creativity, right, in terms of solving a problem. So one of the big things with climate is that it's a big problem, so it needs a big top-down solution. And that may not necessarily be the case in every case, right? So right now, we're sort of stuck because we're looking at the political situation and we're saying, oh, well, our leaders aren't really listening and people don't even believe that this is real. But I was just interviewed by the Wall Street Journal. And I was sort of, and I was like, wow, this is fantastic. Like, you guys are interested? This is amazing. And the writer was like, yeah, actually, our readership is really interested in this. Why? Because they realize that it makes economic sense. So this makes a lot of sense. And it has nothing to do with, you know, whether you're to the right or to the left. Nobody wants to inherit this world or to pass it down to their children.
And Vanessa, one of the things that you include in many of the graphic depictions here is population projections showing that we currently have about 7 billion people living on Earth, and the projection is 10 billion by 2100. That is a factor that could be adjusted, right? We could reduce the population growth in order to try to scale to a planet with less living space.
That is definitely something that's possible. One of the things that one of the reasons that we put that there is because we were not imagining, you know, it's a dystopian utopia, right? So the dystopian part is we got to 4 degrees. The utopian part is somehow we've managed to figure out a way to make this transition without having it be something that turned into war and famine and death. So that was really important to us, to not imagine going through this period of horror that everyone seems to like to sort of throw at people.
Yeah, I've seen Waterworld, and I just hope it doesn't work out that way.
Well, you know, that's not really going to motivate people to do anything to change because it just feels so big. Yes, I think that you know, at the same time, I'm a bit reluctant to talk about population control as such because it turns into one of these thorny issues because of things that have happened in the past.
Indeed.
You think about, well, who's valuable, who's not valuable,
right,
who gets like forcibly sterilized, and, you know, who gets IVF.
Understood.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm not trying to open that. I just want people to recognize that population control is one factor in addressing these substantial changes. And Vanessa, I've turned the page here to sea level rise and tropical cyclones. And you have a graphic here that shows a storm coming in through the Gulf of Mexico right off the coast of Alabama. And we're speaking just a few days after a brutal storm, a tornado with winds of hurricane strength, 150 to 170 miles an hour, plowed through a swath of Alabama. They say about, the width of a football field, but 20 miles long, and destroyed everything in its path. And this is almost prophetic, the way this is displayed in your book.
Well, if you look at the graphics in the book, you can see that the rings that go out from that storm in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, engulf maybe 3/4 of the United States. And that's not even the biggest area of cyclonic action. The biggest one is the one that is engulfing, you know, parts of the African continent and the Philippines and all of that. So these things are going to become a lot bigger. And we see that when we see these storms from space, right? They're very large. I was born in Jamaica. And so when I look at these storms, you can see the outline of Jamaica, and the cloud cover is just, you know, it's completely engulfed. It makes Jamaica look like this tiny, tiny thing that's just, you know, subsumed in this. This is only going to become more intense because I remember when we were doing the research, one of the things that really struck me reading the book 6 Degrees by Mark Linus was when he talks about, have you read that book?
I have not.
Mm-mm. It's fascinating. So he goes back through the fossil record, and he looks at what the world was like 1 degree, 2 degrees, up to 6 degrees warmer. And it's he paints this very vivid picture. And so at 6 degrees, you have hurricanes that can circumnavigate the globe more than, you know, more than one to multiple times until they crash inland far enough and lose power. So that type of scenario is where we're headed as we warm the planet, if we continue to do so. These types of storms, whether it's a hurricane, you know, or whether it's tornadoes, I think that we've seen more of all of these types of things, as well as wildfires from drought. So it's been really interesting and also sad to see all of these things that, you know, that I spent a lot of time reading about coming to the fore in such rapid succession. It has happened a lot faster than anyone thought it would.
Now, speaking of trees, we have more than 100 million dead trees in California as a result of a 5-year drought. And given the projections that you show in the book, should we try to reforest these areas, or should we accept that they're going to be deserts by 2100 and we should be investing in other projects to develop renewable resources and energy?
Well, you know, there's actually a really wonderful tree planting program that's I think it's called the Great Green Wall, and it's taking place across Africa, and it's to combat desertification. And they have planted acacia trees, and what they have found is that the trees actually, like wells that had gone dry, now have water again. So I would never say, okay, just give up and just, you know, it's going to be a desert. I would fight mightily against that. Forests and burning are something that has always taken place. It's something that, you know, the communities that were here before, you know, Western settlers came, you know, used to practice, right? So it's part of, you know, it's part of life. Yes, it is tragic, and yes, there has been a terrible loss of life, and we need to do something about that. But I would never say give up. You know, that's really not my, you know, not my tactic at all. I would look and say, you know, we're trying to combat desertification by planting certain types of trees. We could look at the way that the trees work. They hold water in the soil. They stop topsoil from blowing away. When the topsoil blows away, it becomes a desert because it's not, it no longer has anything, you know, or very little that, you know, that plants can thrive on. So I would say absolutely no to that.
Well, I would ordinarily accuse you of being a relentless optimist, but I think you're grounded here in, you know, very solid research and science, and I will take your advice.
At the same time, I think, you know, one of the reasons that we wanted to look at densification of existing cities and creating settlements that were, you know, where we could have a greater percentage of people. And these, you know, you have to understand these cities are not like what our cities are like now. People react very violently against the idea of having to live like cheek and jowl with a whole bunch of other people. Like, you know, even in a place like New York, New York is a beautiful city, but also, you know, dense and chaotic and frustrating. And people think, well, I don't want to live in that. I want my suburban home. I want my car, you know, but part of the issue is, you know, if we can create cities that have more of what we want. So you're seeing this, you're seeing, you know, people feel lonely. We have an epidemic of loneliness. So, you know, the cost of living is also high. So you have people starting to do things like co-housing, co-living, living arrangements where you combine living and working, such as we're showing in the book. Mm-hmm. If we can green our cities, if we can grow food in our cities, if we can create cities that have more parks and more commonly held amenities and places for people to enjoy nature, then we can really have a win-win, and we can actually leave some of those areas where we have suburban sprawl and that kind of stuff to be areas, you know, for nature, right? I mean, the future that we're envisioning is one where we have mega cities, but these cities are not like what we have today. These are cities where you have a, you know, combined, you know, as I mentioned, all of these sort of overlapping hybrid strategies to use spaces in multiple ways.
But for the benefit, Vanessa, of everyone. you know, I'm an American. I am entitled to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, isolated splendor in a gated community. I don't think you got the memo.
Well, what do you want the future to look like? How much are you willing to, you know, are you willing to, how much are you willing to sacrifice? Because that's, you know, we have to figure out a way forward here. And, you know, I don't know that our current system of occupying land is really working out so great for us.
Yeah. In the graphic pages about energy and shifting to renewables, I just want to note that you do not consider nuclear to be a renewable energy, and I'm glad because there is some somewhat of a split on that.
Well, one of the things you know that I've talked about, I'll send you this graphic. It's something that I use in one of my talks. When we were doing all of the initial research, we started looking at. Do you remember those wedges, like the seven wedges? This was like a strategy, like of how we can get to, like, you know, instead of the business as usual arc of, you know, continually expanding CO2 in the atmosphere, what we can do instead is each one of these things is a wedge that will reduce back to like a baseline how much output we have of CO2. So we started looking at these wedges and we're like, okay, so how much is one wedge of, you know, of all of these different things, one wedge of nuclear or one wedge of, and when I started looking at that, it was terrifying because nuclear starts to look really good in terms of how much territory and space all of these other things take up. So, you know, one wedge of, of wind power take, you know, we have this thing of the United States and there's like this big red square in the middle of how much land you would have to give up just to have nothing but wind power for one wedge.
Mm-hmm.
So you start looking at that and then I think, okay, but this is part of the crisis of imagination because we are thinking about things that are only doing one thing and we can't do that anymore. So my whole thinking is why can we not have these things in cities where we live in our infrastructure? We have like a lot of roads that could be doing this. We have bridges that you could deploy things on, right? They're starting to do it. They have solar panels that are on, you know, lampposts on the highway.
Right.
But we need a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do that, then we don't have to say, okay, everybody got to move. We're going to have this big red square in the middle of the United States, and that's only going to be devoted to wind power. And actually, sorry, guys, but we need seven of these. So a lot more of you are going to have to move.
And then you do calculations on how much energy we need to grow crops. You talk about vertical farming and many other innovative ways to produce the desired outcome with less energy and less space or, you know, other resources required. And you basically go through a lot of the calculations that I guess are the basis for the urban design that you present in the second half of the book.
Yes. And, you know, we're very, in some ways, we're very mathematical. Like, we want to quantify, like, how do we attack this problem? What is the, you know, how can we quantify this? How much space do we need? And so when we started looking at this, we really realized that a huge part of the problem in thinking about the future cities, densification, where we can live, where we can't live, is the fact that we have everything broken up into these categories. And so one of the questions I like to ask audiences when I give a talk is, you know, I'll ask for a show of hands and say, how many of you that you're sitting here, you have two other places that are empty? So you're sitting here listening to me talk and your home or your dorm room or wherever is empty and your office is also empty. Your desk, nobody's there, right? So like there's two places that are not being used because you're sitting here. And when we leave here, this place will be empty too. And it's sort of, and there's usually a fairly large showing of hands. This is changing now though, because now we have people, there's been a revolution in the idea of what work is, where you work. Do you need an office? Can I work in a cafe? Can I work remotely all of the time? So I think that a lot of the ideas that we're presenting in the book are just further development, maybe 80 years on from where we are now. We already have things like working, co-living spaces. We already have things where people are, there's a hybrid space where some people are having lunch and having a coffee, somebody else is working on a laptop. That's what we're talking about when we talk about hybrid strategies. So if we can be smart about how we use space, why can't you grow food in the park? Why does it have to be just one thing? Why can't I have energy that's being developed in the park? Why can't I develop energy from people walking? Because I can.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to do more of this, and we need to think creatively. This is the biggest issue of our time. And I would like to see everybody get on board with finding innovative strategies to tackle these issues. It doesn't have to be top down. Every little bit makes a difference. We got here a little bit at a time, and we need to use every strategy that we can to fix this. And that includes, yes, definitely continue to mobilize politically, continue to talk to our leaders, all of those things. But then there's also the private sector. There's also things that we individually can do. We can also vote with our dollars, right? We can, you know, there's been a lot of focus now on plastics and on packaging and on what we can do about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that companies feel the pressure. Hey, you know, we don't want to just take your stuff. I don't want my, you know, my plastic to wash up on the beach when I'm on vacation. So you guys have to do something about this. And there is a response.
So, Vanessa, in the book, after the kind of the presentation of data, you move to specific design plans for existing regions or areas. And let me invite you to talk about Phoenix and then New York City, because I think many people can relate to those very different geographical areas. So you describe Phoenix, pardon me, in 2100 as an extraction city. Explain what that means to our listeners, please.
Okay, well, we have two kinds of cities in this world. So I described the sort of middle band of the world before. And so the extraction cities are the cities that are in that area. They still have populations, but they are not megacities. They do not have large-scale populations. Why? Because when you have storms, when you have fires, when you have all of these kinds of things, it's much harder to recover if you have a city of of millions and millions of people, whether, you know, or if you have a smaller settlement. So the idea is that what can we do with these areas in the middle? We can maintain smaller scale populations. There are things that we can still do with these areas. And we have a map where we talk about all of the different types of energy that can be generated in these places. Some of them, you know, for example, we talk about Sao Paulo has value because of the rainforest, and the rainforest is tremendously valuable for all of the medicinal extracts and also in general for its impact on the climate. For the case of Phoenix, we really wanted to look, you know, we wanted to look at a place that is known to be, you know, a fairly unsustainable city in the sense that water reserves are being taken from, I think from, you know,
I have
underground
it right here.
Reserves.
Well, you say the Colorado River.
The Colorado River.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're using water that actually was, you know, was meant to be used for agriculture, and I think the farmers are sort of like selling off their water rights to you know, communities for people to use. And you know, we know that that the water's running out. So what do we do in a place like this? And what do we do in American suburbia? Because we really wanted to look at, you know, that type of, you can see, let me see, there's one, I think it's like maybe the first visualization that we have, which is just the community
mm-hmm.
that the settlement is in. And you see, you know, your typical sort of American, you know, ranch or a split level house. And we've adapted all of these. We said, okay, we're going to have, you know, algae farming on the roof. We're going to retrofit these buildings with wind technology. We're going to see, you know, we have a lot of existing stuff. And I feel when I was doing this research, I found a lot of really great examples of greenfield situations where somebody would say, okay, this is, I think one of them is called Dongtan. This is, you know, there's so many of these where we're going to make a green new city, and we're going to take this piece of land where there's nothing, and we're going to put this thing in here, and it's going to be perfect. And I don't know if there are that many examples of that actually working. And we have a lot of stuff. So the idea was, what can we do with the stuff? So if Phoenix becomes a place where, and, you know, I'm not imagining people being forced out. You know, I think people are already moving because of the climate of their own accord, right? So, you know, maybe the population goes down and you have these areas where people are focused on how can we generate alternative forms of clean energy. And so we have this settlement, which is separated into different districts. We have a, you know, we have an urban farming district. We have a solar district, a wind district, a water collection district, and a carbon capture district. And mm-hmm. we have all of these different types of technologies of clip-on architecture that I mentioned, which are deployed on the existing buildings and on the existing infrastructure. So we also show, and I've never given this talk in Phoenix. I would love to. one of my team members actually did some calculations on, okay, how long would it take us with a bunch of crews to actually take down the rest of the buildings that we're not using, green deconstruct, and recycle them? Because there's actually value in everything. And I think we have like less than 1 year, you know, if we really worked hard on it. And then we're showing, you know, in these series of maps, how we can transform these areas either into, you know, areas where we're generating energy or areas where we have combined energy generating and an outpost settlement.
Now, let me turn to the greatest city in the world where you are based, New York. And you are going to define that in the future as an extraction city as well, where Vancouver will be a compact mega city. So you're saying that New York will not be able to sustain the density of population that it has today. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, how many more, how many more hurricanes do we want to withstand? Again, this is a dystopian utopia. I'm not saying that this is what I want for New York or Phoenix or anywhere. What I'm trying to do is raise awareness of many potential solutions that we should do now. But yes, for New York, we're showing a couple of, of different scenarios. And what we're imagining is, I show the Gowanus Canal, and we look at the Gowanus Canal. If you look at the page where we've got, we're showing, that site in 2014, 2050, and then we show it in 2100. And, the Gowanus Canal is substantially flooded. You mentioned Dutch engineering before. We looked a lot at, how they deal with flooding. And so we have a storm surge barrier, but we have a multi-layered approach. So sort of at the mouth of the canal, what we have is a storm surge barrier. And then further in, we have, soft edges. So the soft edges are a park. So we have an energy park, which has, again, sort of light infrastructure that is carbon capture and wind energy technology. And then further back beyond is where we have our, more valuable infrastructure. So that there's a multi-pronged approach to this. When you have a storm coming, you can close your storm surge barrier. You also have turbines that can be underneath the surface of the water. And the whole idea is that we can stop the force of the waves enough that it won't damage our technology, but then we can generate energy from it. Mm-hmm. So some of these storms have so much energy. If we could harness the energy, even like a fraction of the power that is in one of these storms, we wouldn't be, fracking or trying to, extract the last drop of petroleum from anywhere. We would just, be able to, power a city for years on a fraction of the intensity that's in one of those storms. So that's one of the ideas that we were looking at in places like New York and Manila.
Mm-hmm. So, Vanessa, there is much more in this book, and I really find it fascinating, inspiring, and it gives us a sense of hope that I haven't, as I mentioned at the introduction, I haven't been finding in so much other media that is available about the impact of climate change. And I'd like to ask where you developed your skills as a visionary, and what you use to activate your visionary sensibilities. Is it coffee? Is it do you meditate? Is there a place you go where ideas come to you? Because, I mean, you really do have a remarkable skill that is exhibited in this book to imagine things without the constraint of being restricted to the way we view them today.
Well, I definitely do meditate. I'm a problem solver. And like I told you, because of my background, I have never, you know, I have always come from the perspective of being able to see two sides of a story, being able to understand multiple perspectives, having to, you know, go to places where, you know, and so in a sense, like fitting in nowhere means that I was able to fit in everywhere, and I was able to really galvanize, you know, people and talk to people across difference. And so even the team who worked on this, I mean, you know, they were from all over the place. And I loved that because it was really interesting. We could have conversations in the office about, oh, you know, well, this is very similar to, you know, oh, back home, we do it this way. And so, you know, I found that to be very motivating. I've always been a very visual person. So I was very, very, you know, interested in the idea of being able to create something that was visually arresting and that would bring people into the story and would motivate them with a view of the future that is very different, but at the same time is not terrible. Because I feel that, you know, the entire discussion around climate, yes, the numbers are dire, yes, all of these things, but what are we going to do about that? Are you just going to say, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to enjoy the rest of my life and not worry about this, and, you know, good luck, grandchildren and children and, you know, future generations? Or are we going to say, you know what, it's not working, let's fix it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really my approach. It's not working, you know, like, we need to change, yes, but this is a huge opportunity for positive change. I think that the way that things are is not working for more than just the environment. So this is really an opportunity. What kind of an incredible world can we craft out of this crisis?
And have you sent a copy to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
And, no, I have not.
I certainly think it could inform the new Green Deal.
That would be amazing. I would love to be a part of that. I would love to be a part of, you know, I encourage your, you know, listeners all over the world, please contact me. I am up for collaboration. I want to develop these things. A lot of the things that we started looking at were ideas. We took, you know, somebody's researching this over here, somebody's researching that over there, these two technologies. And my team would say, oh, but wouldn't that be cool if we could take that bladeless turbine idea and we could combine that with this other idea over here for how we can absorb CO2, and we put those two things and we put them in a park.
Mm-hmm.
What if we take that stuff and could we put it in the swing sets that are in the park, or, you know, different types of things like on the facade? You know, can we do some of these things? And so the next step, the thing that, you know, one of the things that we were talking about at Drawdown Learn at the end of the conference was, let's do some demonstration projects. Let's take some of these things and really develop them. And that's really what I feel like is the next step for me with this type of stuff. I would really, really love to collaborate to be part of positive change, not just politically and talking to people, but actually in terms of developing the technologies and techniques and showing people that this can work.
All right. Let me offer this as a first stage of collaboration. I want to challenge my listeners to provide a pathway to get a copy of 2100, A Dystopian Utopia. That's the book we're talking about, to both Senator Ed Markey, who is the Democrat from Massachusetts who introduced the Green New Deal resolution in the Senate, and Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, who is spearheading the effort in the House. And let's see if we can find a path to make sure that we can get this in front of those leaders and see if we can influence some of their thinking with these really fresh ideas and dramatic presentations of them in your book. So let's start there.
That sounds fantastic. I would love that.
All right. We'll see if we can make that happen. I will post a link, pardon me, to your website at studioteca.com, and that's how people can arrange to send an email to you if they are so inclined, and you're willing to bring your talk to communities and to collaborate with people. So let's see what the Peter B. Collins community can do to support those aspirations.
That's wonderful. I really, really appreciate that. I've just been working so hard to get the word out. And, you know, I've done this just, I mean, it has been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but also a lot of joy. I've done this with, you know, again, I don't have major institutional support. You know, I've been like shoestringing it. I've spoken to everyone from a community garden to, 400 people at the Louisville Sustainability Summit. And, you know, I just want to find collaborators to get the word out that we can do something about this and to connect the dots so that we have a beautiful future to pass on to future generations.
And your publisher, Urban Research, is going to contribute 5 copies of 2100, A Dystopian Utopia, that I'll be giving away to listeners over the next couple of months. So we're going to get a few books in circulation, and I've got some very active listeners scattered all over the country and around the world, and we'll see what we can do to build some momentum for you, Vanessa.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. Tell people to contact me. I'm so open to that. Let's do it. Let's roll up our sleeves and let's make it happen.
All right. Vanessa Keith, thanks for joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Vanessa Keith. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails.